It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about some great ways to get outside, enjoy nature, and do some volunteer work on Earth Day in Wisconsin.
First, the University of Wisconsin system has been under a tuition freeze for the last 4 years. During this year's State of the State address, Governor Walker called for a system-wide tuition cut.
Officials with the UW system have said that the tuition freeze, coupled with potential budget cuts, won't be sustainable in the long term. Now, some lawmakers are saying that they might consider lifting the tuition freeze.
Nico Savage joins us now to talk about what this could all mean for the University of Wisconsin. He's the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Nico, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us the background here. Why did we have this tuition freeze in the first place?
Well, the tuition freeze was put in place in 2013 after a couple of things happened. One was some sizable tuition increases from the UW system in the years that preceded it. And then also you had the discovery by lawmakers of reserve funds that the university was keeping in the midst of these tuition increases, funds of hundreds of millions of dollars that lawmakers basically viewed as the university holding that money while raising tuition on students. They instituted the freeze then, and that's where we've been basically for the past 4 years.
The UW system has wanted to end that freeze, but then in his State of the State address, Governor Walker, I think, surprised some people when he said his budget was going to include, ultimately, tuition cuts for students at the UW system. What was the case he was making there?
Sure, and it did surprise people. Actually, the talk from UW officials prior to the State of the State address was that they believe the governor was open to ending the tuition freeze in the second year of the 2017-19 budget. The rationale for the tuition cut, the governor said, was essentially that he wanted to give Wisconsin families a break and to actually lower the cost of tuition. Now, of course, other folks looking at that said, well, this is a governor who's considering running for re-election in 2018, and the tuition freeze has been popular, and what's going to be more popular than a tuition freeze? Well, a tuition cut. So there are a lot of potential reasons for it.
And now lawmakers, in his own party included, are not necessarily jumping on board with this tuition cut idea, including, as we were saying, some saying, hey, maybe it's time to end the tuition freeze. Who is speaking out on this? What are we hearing?
Sure. So we've actually heard from several lawmakers, many of the top representatives in the legislature, who have come out and said that they basically see better uses for the money that Governor Walker wants to spend on the tuition cut than on an across-the-board tuition cut. I actually haven't heard from anybody in the legislature who's come out and said that they think it's a great idea, at least from the Republican side, because the governor is proposing spending $35 million to essentially replace the revenue that UW system would lose from a tuition cut. And this is a budget where there's already a lot of kind of controversy over what different priorities are going to get funded. What's happened more recently is we've now had two members of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee who have come out and said, you know, not only are we not in favor of the tuition cut, we're also open to looking at an end to the tuition freeze. Representative John Nygren basically telling me earlier this week that we can't freeze tuition forever. And Representative Del Kienga saying that he's open to, as he put it, a kind of limited, modest UW flexibilities in tuition. So basically a limited ability for the university system to raise tuition.
And one thing some lawmakers have floated is the idea that, okay, an across-the-board tuition cut is going to be pretty small change for a lot of families, and it'll help people a little who maybe don't need it. Why not take that money and target it to the people who need it most? What are they looking for there?
Right. So they've basically said that would not be as effective as targeting that in terms of need-based financial aid. So there's been some talk of potentially taking some of the money, some of the $35 million that would be spent on the tuition freeze, and putting that into financial aid. To give you a sense of what the governor's proposing, he's calling for a 5% tuition cut, which would for undergraduates on average around the UW system, it'd be about $360 per year. At UW-Madison, that'd be close to about $500. So that kind of gives you a sense of what sort of savings would be involved in that. And it's worth noting that cut would only be in the second year of the two-year budget. Right now, the governor's proposal would be to keep tuition frozen the first year, the coming school year, 2017-18, and then cut it in 2018-19.
Talking to Nico Savage from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at tuition cuts, tuition freezes for UW-Madison, rifts between the governor and his budget and some key Republican state lawmakers. Nico, let's look at the big picture of the UW system budget. When the tuition freezes came in, you mentioned those reserve funds. Republican lawmakers looked at those and said, hey, the system's flush with cash. The system said, well, hold on, some of this is for specific building projects, rainy day funds in case you guys in the legislature cut our budgets in the future, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where are we now after these tuition freezes and other funding cuts along the way?
Yeah, there has been spending from those reserves. In fact, 2 years ago, a little less than 2 years ago, after the lawmakers approved a state budget that cut UW system funding by $250 million in the kind of current budget biennium, a lot of universities and the UW system as a whole were spending out of those rainy day funds, and were spending those down over the past couple of years. Now, there still are sizable amounts of money, and there are still hundreds of millions of dollars in those reserves, and lawmakers are still pointing to those and saying they're concerned about them. But UW system officials say, we've been spending from these accounts, and it's not sustainable to keep doing so. They've been heartened by the governor's budget proposal, where he calls for $42.5 million in new funding over the next 2 years. But they're saying that they also want that authority back over tuition.
The relationship between UW system officials and Republicans in the legislature has not always been real friendly in the last few years. As we hear this debate about tuition cut, tuition freeze, what's the tone like?
Well, yeah, I think it was summed up pretty well by John Nygren when I spoke with him earlier this week. He said, there has been a lot of kind of relationship building that's gone on between UW and the legislature, and there is more trust there. But I think there is still a little bit of trepidation and a desire among some lawmakers to maintain a certain amount of control at the legislature level over UW tuition. So one of the ideas that was floated by Del Quienga was essentially allowing for tuition increases that would be capped by the percentage increases in median household income or the consumer price index, essentially putting a ceiling on any tuition increases. And Representative Nygren said that's something he's open to looking into.
Now, looking at the system, we've got individual campuses and their leadership, the system as a whole and its leadership, and then kind of floating above that is the Board of Regents. What are they saying about all these issues?
Well, the Board of Regents last fall approved a sort of tuition plan that was essentially the board saying, hey, if you give us this authority, here's what we're going to do. And what they pledged to do over the next 2 years was keep tuition flat in the first year, in the coming fall school year, and then only raise it by, and this is similar to what Representative Kiyanga mentioned, raise it by a percentage that is not greater than the percentage increase of the consumer price index. So essentially, raising it around the levels of inflation or consumer prices. And they say that that's a modest increase, but that ultimately, the way that things are set up, the Board of Regents is historically the body that's been setting tuition prices. And members were saying last fall, this is our job. It's not the legislature's job. We want this authority back. The question is if the legislature is going to give them that authority back.
All this wrangling back and forth over the system budget, this is kind of a huge question, Nico, but for a student in UW system schools, for parents and high school kids who are maybe doing campus tours now, does this all really have an impact on their lives and on their pocketbooks?
Well, I think it would. I mean, you look at the difference between a tuition cut and potentially a tuition increase could be several hundred dollars, and that's certainly sizable, but I think some of the things that UW officials have been saying basically are Assistant President Ray Cross said, you don't want to get tuition tunnel vision, as he put it, saying that there's a lot of factors that affect college affordability. So, you might cut tuition. This is the example they give. You might cut tuition, you might freeze tuition, but if a student is not able to get in all the classes that he or she needs and has to stay for an extra semester or an extra year, well, you saved a few hundred dollars, but you got to spend a few thousand dollars more on that. So that's one of the issues that they bring up, which is that it's not quite so cut and dry as, if you cut tuition or you freeze tuition, college is going to necessarily be cheaper because there's those other factors that can affect it.
We'll leave it there for now. Nico, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nico Savage, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about the UW system tuition freeze and why that may be lifted, at least according to some state lawmakers. Earth Day is coming up this Saturday. It's an opportunity to celebrate the natural world and also to take care of it. State parks around Wisconsin are putting out a call for volunteers to help with a variety of activities, from planting trees and painting park benches to picking up litter and clearing out invasive species.
Janet Hutchins joins us now to fill us in on the opportunities to help Wisconsin parks this coming Earth Day. She's the Friends and Volunteer Coordinator for the Wisconsin State Park System with the Wisconsin DNR. Janet, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, Janet, why is pitching in on the Wisconsin State Parks, doing some of this invasive species clearing, picking up litter, why is this a good idea on Earth Day?
Well, typically people like to get outside for Earth Day and do something positive to help care for our natural resources and get their hands dirty and do a real environmental project. And so it's also a good time of year when our staff are sprucing up the state properties, getting ready for the busy season when everybody like to get out and go for that hike or start camping or ride their bike on the trail. So it's a great time to get outside early in the season and give our staff a hand with some of our spring cleaning and sprucing things up.
How important is this kind of volunteer work to the maintenance of the state parks?
It's really important. We really appreciate the help our volunteers give us, and our volunteers put in 2,640 hours last year, and we had quite a few volunteers join us for our Earth Day event. And every year, we have more and more volunteers helping us out, and that helps us get up and going for the season a lot quicker. And it's just a great way for folks to get involved with the park system and really give a hand.
And what kinds of activities can we do if we decide, yeah, this sounds like something I want to get involved with? What sorts of things can we choose from?
So we have a lot of different activities happening at our events, like planting trees. That's a seasonal favorite. Picking up litter along the roadway or that may have blown into the parks in the wintertime. Clearing away leaves and sticks that might have fallen in our camping areas during the wintertime. Also painting picnic tables and pulling invasive plants that are in the park area.
Now, do we need training to do these kinds of things, or can you get a little on-the-spot training when you get there?
Yeah, this is all on-the-spot, on-the-job training. It's pretty easy. So we just let volunteers know how to do the activity and then have them pitch in.
Now, I want to zero in particular on some of the opportunities that are out there, because this is a statewide kind of event. And let's focus in on Wisconsin's Kettle Moraine Forest, a beautiful area. What kind of help is needed there?
So at our southern unit at Ottawa Lake, we're replacing trees that were lost to the emerald ash borer that hit the area pretty hard in 2015 and 2016. And we need help mulching around all the newly planted trees in our picnic area and campground areas to help those trees grow well and retain moisture in the summertime. But in our northern unit, we're cleaning up along the Kettle Moraine Scenic Drive, picking up litter, and then our volunteers can enjoy snacks and refreshments with our local friends group there.
So is there kind of a sense of camaraderie? You go out there, there's other volunteers, there's some food that always makes people feel festive. Did you get to know some people who are like-minded?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really great when everybody comes together and lends a hand with a common purpose, and especially on Earth Day, it's just a really great way to all pitch in and help our natural resources, and it is a great time to make new friends and see what other people are doing to help the parks.
Now, Wisconsin's waterways, the lakes, the rivers, the streams are a big part of what makes the state so beautiful. What kinds of things can people do to help out there?
So some of our activities along the lake shore, along Lake Michigan, Harrington Beach, we are doing some picnic area cleanup and working on the shelter and fixing up the grills in the picnic area in general. And then we also have events at Lakeshore State Park along Lake Michigan and Bigfoot Beach State Park.
So some opportunities there. And looking at, you know, some of the more, you mentioned the shelters, and I'm thinking about the picnic benches too. You know, we usually don't think about what we're sitting on. We just assume that it's there. But it sounds like a lot of the parks need help with fresh paint, getting those benches ready to go in the new season. What kinds of things can people do there? Maybe especially if they've got some skill with a paintbrush.
Yeah, several of our parks like Harrington Beach and Point Beach State Forest and Merrick State Park all need help with painting the benches and getting them in really nice condition for our picnickers in the summertime and making them look really nice. So, yeah, getting the brush out and getting some new paint, fresh paint on those picnic tables is going to make picnicking a lot nicer experience for our visitors.
Now, this is work, it's volunteer work, but it sounds like there's some play involved in this too. You work hard and then there you are in this beautiful state park. What kinds of things happen when the volunteer part of it is done?
So a lot of our friends groups who support our specific parks on a local level are providing picnics and activities right after the work event. So you can join in with maybe a hike or a talk and enjoy the food and the camaraderie.
Now, how many volunteers typically show up on a day like this?
We have anywhere from a handful of volunteers to a couple hundred at any particular park. It just depends on the event and how many folks come out. But on in a typical year, last year we had 825 people throughout the park system participate in Work Play Earth Day. And that's just for that one event. But throughout the year, we have over 8,000 volunteers who put in time in our parks, and we really appreciate all the help that they provide us. And that includes our friends groups who volunteer on a more often basis, specifically for a park, trail, or recreation area.
Janet Hutchins is with us. She's the Friends and Volunteer Coordinator for the Wisconsin State Park System with the Wisconsin DNR. And we're talking about volunteer opportunities at state parks in Wisconsin all over the state this coming Earth Day. And Janet, we're talking about this in terms of Earth Day coming up, but it sounds as though there are opportunities beyond Earth Day, but maybe clustered around there. What kind of dates are you looking at?
The dates this year for our celebration begin tomorrow at Mirror Lake State Park, and then on Saturday, April 22nd, on Earth Day, we have 17 locations hosting events around the state, anywhere from Lake Geneva to Sturgeon Bay. And then again on Saturday, April 29th, we have 7 locations holding Earth Day, Work Play Earth Day events, and then also again on Saturday, May 6th. And you can find all of those activities on the DNR website by typing in Work Play Earth Day.
Now, I imagine this could be a good opportunity not only to do something good for the state parks, especially if you're a regular user of the state parks, but what if you want to get to know a new natural area? Should you check out this list and maybe try to see a new state park?
Absolutely. I'd recommend and encourage anyone to discover a new park this spring. Pick a park in the part of the state that you haven't been to before and discover the gems that we have all around the state. Every park has its unique features and habitats to check out, so I would encourage everyone to try a new park this spring.
Right. I mean, Wisconsin has a big state park system. Are there parks within that system that you think get overlooked and maybe we should check out and pay a little more attention to?
Yeah, there are all kinds of parks that folks can visit. And right here in our area, we have the McKenzie Environmental Center. But as far up as the end of Door County, we have Newport State Park, where we have our pretty dark skies up there, and the stargazing is really incredible.
Is that the park in Door County, Newport?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Ellison Bay.
So what happens at the dark skies event?
Well, during the summer they put on specific dark sky stargazing events specifically for that, because they are out away from lots of artificial lighting, and so it's really a unique place to see the all the constellations and to really get a good look at the sky in the summertime.
Okay, so let's say you pick your state park, you show up, and I'm thinking that we've got to be creeping up on tick season already. What kinds of clothing should you wear to be prepared for the kind of work you're going to be doing?
Yeah, that's a good good point. We would like folks to take a look at the activity that they want to join in with, and on our website we have a list of what you'll need to have for that particular activity on that day. But generally, pair of gloves, pair of long pants, some work shoes or hiking boots, maybe a hat, sunglasses if it's sunny out. So just kind of general outdoor gear that you would use to work out in your yard.
Now there's a big effort right now because it's Earth Day and you want to get the volunteers out there to get these parks ready for the high season. But are these opportunities that also exist elsewhere, other times during the year?
Yes, we have volunteer activities happening year-round. So if folks are interested in volunteering beyond our three-weekend event, they can go on to the Volunteer Opportunities webpage on the DNR website for Wisconsin State Parks, Trails, and Recreation Areas and check out the other events that we have going on throughout the year. And then we also have volunteer opportunities for campground hosting, for nature center hosts or naturalists, for special projects like invasive species or maybe doing building and maintenance type of work. So there's all kinds of volunteer activities that are available within the during the whole year.
And Janet, are you going to be helping out this coming weekend?
Yeah, I am. I'm taking my family to Kohler Andre State Park. That's a place that I grew up going to and camping at a lot. So I'm looking forward to that.
Terrific. That's a beautiful park. Janet, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Veronica.
That was Janet Hutchins. She's the Friends and Volunteer Coordinator for the Wisconsin State Park System with the Wisconsin DNR, joining us there to talk about volunteer opportunities at state parks in Wisconsin on this coming Earth Day.
If you are in one of those friends groups at an area state park, definitely send us a message or post on the Central Time Facebook page about what's going on in your neck of the woods for Earth Day, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, there's a lot of talk about the value of creativity, but a guest says schools, businesses, and other organizations actually resist creative thinking. She says there are some hurdles we need to overcome to harness the power of our creativity. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Tonight at 7:30, Tom Ashbrook is at Milwaukee's Latino Arts Center for a live show on race in the age of President Trump. Tune into a live stream on Wisconsin Public Radio's Facebook page.
First, I ask you this question. Is creativity good or bad? No-brainer, right? Most of us are thinking, yeah, of course, creativity, pretty good thing. And a lot of employers these days and surveys say creativity is one of the most important traits they look for in their employees.
So we think we like creativity, but our next guest says in real life we fear it, we resist it, and we actively suppress it. In schools, businesses, and in our daily lives, we tend to reject creative ideas in favor of familiar ones.
Jennifer Mueller joins us now. She's a social psychologist, associate professor at the University of San Diego, and author of the new book, Creative Change: Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So we love creativity in theory, but not necessarily in practice. Why is that?
I suppose that's in some ways very shocking for some people. And in other situations, we might think, of course, that's true. Of course, we love the status quo. Survival of the fittest, right? If stuff has existed for a long time, it must be good. Otherwise, why would we do it? But the problem, of course, with that thinking is just because something exists doesn't actually mean it's good. So when I started asking this question, I'm asking this, of course, as a social psychologist in a field that studies generating ideas and generate more and more ideas. The more ideas, the better. And you'll hear this frequently from many people who talk about how to cultivate creativity in an organization or in a school. And so the result is you have skunk works. That is, you put creativity in an environment where, okay, now is the time to be creative and everybody's going to brainstorm ideas, or students are going to be creative now, and all that's all great and fine. And then the question is, what happens next? Where do those ideas go? And, well, we assumed that if an idea is great and if an idea is really creative, it'll, I don't know, get implemented. People will like it. People will endorse it and embrace it. But what we found and what we're finding is the opposite, is that the more creative an idea is, the less likely it is to be endorsed. And in fact, what we find is that when ideas are creative, decision makers and other gatekeepers are more likely to have a negative knee-jerk reaction to this idea than they are to say, wow, that idea is amazing, it's creative, let's embrace it. So there's a problem in how we're evaluating these ideas, and I wanted to write a book to help people learn how to do better.
Right, and you've done experiments on this, you've done research on this. It really seems to come to that again and again, doesn't it? When we're faced with a status quo type alternative or creative alternative, we tend to lean toward that status quo.
That's right. And one of the studies, I think the most well-known study that we conducted with Shmuel Malani and Jack Gonzalo, what we did was we wanted to know if this reaction was something people were aware of, or at least if they would admit it. You know, would people admit this dislike or rejection of creativity? Would they say, yes, no, creativity is not what I want, or I don't like it, or even I hate it? So what we did is we brought people in the lab and we asked them. We said, do you like creativity? And then we gave them a reaction time test where we asked them to pair words like creative with words like heaven or words like vomit. And we found that across the board, people said they love creativity and they paired words like creative with words like heaven. All well and good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then we put people in a mindset that's not as tolerant of creativity. We asked people to write a statement. For every problem, there's one correct solution. We asked people to write an essay in response to that statement. Or for every problem, there's multiple solutions. So we randomly assigned them to focus on there's a correct solution, like, you know, a multiple choice test, for example, or there's multiple possible solutions. And then when we asked them, do you love creativity? Everybody across the board said, yeah, I love creativity. But when we gave them the reaction time test, the people who were in the mindset about there's one correct solution associated the word creative with the word vomit, even though they told us they love creativity. And when they saw a creative idea, they said, that's not creative. So what we found was that people may not be aware of, or they may not be willing to admit, the creativity vomit connection. And furthermore, this test was done with undergraduates in a liberal arts university. This reaction we saw happen amongst people who are super, super high on openness to experience, which is a personality variable we find is very much related to whether or not people can generate these ideas. So it suggests just because you can generate a lot of ideas does nothing in terms of your ability to then stop this knee-jerk reaction from taking you over and rejecting the creative ideas that you might need, solutions you might need, perhaps when you need them most.
Talking to Jennifer Mueller, her new book is Creative Change, Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. Jennifer, a scary question maybe. We say good things about creativity, but what if the reason we deep down don't like it that much is, well, maybe it's not that good. Maybe it's not that important. Is creativity really something that is that much of a value?
This is such a deep and wonderful question. You know, whether or not we need to be more creative and we need to speed up or not is something that I think, you know, we can debate forever. If you look at, for example, artificial intelligence, people say, don't slow down. Don't go there. you know, we don't want to create beings who could effectively exterminate us, for example. In other cases, we think about innovation where you have the choice of dying or taking a new medication no one has ever taken before. And in that case, we're like, well, no, we really need a better way in that context. So I think it's very context dependent. But I do think that there are situations when we know we can do better. It's hard to know, though, when we're already succeeding. This is what happened at RIM. You may recall BlackBerry. And you may recall that RIM was doing extremely well at one point. So well, even though pretty much the market was turning in a different direction, for example, to what is now an iPhone. And so at the time, they couldn't turn because they saw the metrics and the metrics looked great. So it's really hard to know when you need creativity. But I would say that if we can train ourselves to learn how to recognize it, we might do a better job at winnowing through the ideas that are really bad and problematic and choosing and being able to be open to the ideas we really need.
Let's talk about how we as individuals can overcome some of these obstacles. How can we, you talk about disrupting our thinking to be more creative. How can we, sitting at home or sitting in the office, whatever, do that?
It's really hard to learn this skill. So what I'll say is there was in 2010, IBM conducted a survey amongst 1,500 leaders and asked these leaders, nominate the number one leadership skill you think people need to lead in this new economy, globalization and changing regulations and rules and whatnot. And overwhelmingly, they said creativity. And what they meant by creativity was the ability to embrace uncertainty, to recognize opportunity, and to basically manage disruptive change. But they also said 50% or more of these executives admitted they didn't feel trained. They didn't feel that they had the skills to do this kind of thinking. And why is that? That's kind of astounding because most of those executives in that sample probably had MBAs and probably had extensive training in decision making. And so how do we know to make decisions? Well, we know when we make a decision, we look at the metrics. If the metrics are bad, for example, if nobody has, it doesn't have Facebook likes or other investors or people aren't buying something, we think it's bad, right? It's not a good idea. If the metrics are good, we assume, okay, that must be a good idea. And that's pretty much a universal way we've taught people in finance and accounting and whatnot to think about making decisions, to look at the hard data. Here's the problem, though. The hard data when it comes to a creative idea is typically really buggy, like buggy to the point to which it's almost not worth using and thinking of as the metric, as the indicator of success. I mean, I think the Bloomberg Business just came out with their review of the Juicero juicer. Have you seen this?
Yes.
This is a juicer that is super high tech, and it comes with a packet of something, and you put it in the juicer, and it's supposed to communicate to, I don't know, the central office to know if the juice is fresh and whatnot, and it pours out juice. Well, they just did a very clever video of the juicer, this high-tech machine, it's white, it looks designed beautifully, versus a person squeezing the bag into a cup. And they find that the high-tech juicer with all of this power is just as good as a person squeezing the juice into a cup. Well, investors spent $120 million on the Juicero. And so people are kind of laughing, thinking, what were they investing in? And the possibility is the investors were investing in the fact that other investors were investing. You see what I'm saying? But the problem with those kind of metrics of the number of investors investing is that people are following the herd. But that's the problem, is people aren't actually looking at the product and really vetting it and determining, is it really good and is there a use? Why would I need a $400 juicer if I could take the packet of juice and pour it into a glass? So there's this issue with these metrics. They're just not, you know, people are trained to use them, but I don't think they're trained to use them in the way they need to be used when an idea is really new. Because when an idea is really new, the metrics are buggy, you can fake them, you can buy Facebook likes from India, or the idea itself is great, they just didn't pivot to the right audience yet, or they don't yet have metrics because it's so new they haven't put it on the market. So one thing to do is to kind of think about, are you in this mindset that wants that correct solution? Remember in the laboratory, we put people in this kind of mindset around there's a correct solution. And in business, that means you focus on best practices, right? Because something to be the best, you have to vet it. You have to know it's better than something else. It means that you're not focusing on accuracy. Instead, you know, inventors don't necessarily think in that way. And what inventors do when they look at a metric is they say, huh, I wonder why people are doing this. I wonder what this means. I wonder how this idea could be improved. So they look at the metric to tell them how the product needs to improve in the future, not the value of the product now. And I think that kind of a shift in mindset in the way we evaluate ideas could really make a huge difference in the extent to which people can kind of open up and see value in the new where they might not otherwise.
We're talking about creativity with Jennifer Mueller. Her new book is Creative Change, Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. She says we all think we like creative thinking, but in real life, on the job, maybe in school, we tend to stifle and resist creativity.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you have room to be creative in your work, in your studies, in your daily life? Or do creative ideas get shot down, maybe by your boss, your colleagues, or that nagging inner voice that doesn't seem to want to take a chance on something new? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
Jennifer Mueller is with us talking about creativity and why we love it and fear it. Her new book is called Creative Change, Why We Resist It and How We Can Embrace It.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you have the room to be creative, maybe at your workplace, in your daily life, in your schooling? And is that creativity embraced? Do people run with the creative new solutions, fun new ideas, or do they just get quashed like a bug? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great topic. It's one that I hold dear to my heart because I help people get through their blocks to get to their full potential of their own creative inner being. And I have a question here. What do we do now that the great authority of education for the country had decided back in the 80s to not do what Richard Feynman and a group of very intelligent men suggested that we do, teach the young children basic elementary physics before we teach them anything to do with numbers, because that would have changed their mindset of how they learn and how they think, and then they would have been able to come up with all of the answers that we need now. And these children would have been like in their 30s and 40s now. What do we do because the system said no?
Gail, thanks for the call. Jennifer, I don't know if you know about that specific debate, but you do talk about education. Are we educating in a way that encourages creativity?
Well, I'll tell you what the data is showing with respect to creativity in education. What the data is showing is that the millennial generation, is just as able to generate original ideas as prior generations, but they have less interest in elaborating on these ideas. That means they have less motivation around explaining their ideas and going into detail about them. There was another survey that was done that showed that relative to other generations, millennials had more anxiety around embracing creativity and running with creativity. We know that the millennial generation, I think, is the least likely generation to start up businesses, new businesses, which was a major engine of economic growth and new jobs. So our young people, it seems, the data would say, that they're not able to generate the ideas, but they're not necessarily able to embrace them and articulate them and implement them and go and run with it and take the risks associated with it. And the question is, what's going on? It could be, and one possibility is, we see a rise in this way of teaching and a way of thinking about teaching as reducing ambiguity for the student and giving them lots of assignments where the goal is to help them understand, to learn and memorize and to find the correct answer, right? And like in a multiple choice test. And that's really important, because as teachers, you really want to fairly grade students. If there's no right answer, how do you know who to give an A and who to give a C? Because giving that person, a child, a C might mean they can't get into the school of their choice. It can really impact their life. So you want that to be fair. And having correct solutions really helps with that. But creativity in that context is a real nuisance. You know, when I personally give exercises and tell students to be creative, they hate it. In fact, one student was saying to me, Jennifer, you know, Professor Mueller, you know, maybe it's too late for us. Because the truth is, we just want to know what will get us the A. We want to know. And with creativity, we can't know because there's no rubric. There's no specific way you can tell us to be creative. I think that's a little extreme. And I think that, you know, education's just gone and veered on one end of giving people a lot of assignments with correct answers. But there's another way to approach education, and some places are already doing this, where you are focusing on children taking a project all the way through. So this is like in science fairs, right, where they have a project, they have an idea, they have to execute it, they have to communicate it, and then they get to see the gatekeepers and how the gatekeepers respond to it.
And that interaction, right, the idea that you might not get the first prize if you're doing something creative, and why is that so, and you've got to keep pushing, and, you know, what does it mean? What does this word failure even mean if at the end of it all you had a great time and you learned something new, and maybe down the road, you know, you had a great story for your college admissions? So I think that there's a really wonderful dialogue to be having in education right now that's not being had. And I think there's a big problem that we face, and it's resulting in fewer jobs. And I think this is something we should start to address in our policy and educate our educators how to feel comfortable with creativity and bring it back into the classroom now that it's gone.
Let's go back to our callers now. Pam is on the line in Beloit. Pam, hi.
She just said all that I wanted to say that was so good. But it is about education, but it is also about an energy of the, I think it's the male-female energy of power control, this is the right answer, versus the motivation that women have for creating. It's the, you know, build a woman a home and what do you have? Build a woman a house and then she creates the home. It's an essence of beauty that needs to be taught that's from the intersection of your unique individual soul exposing itself to the unknown.
Pam, thanks for the call. A bit metaphysical there, Jennifer, but is there something to that, the willing to, in some ways, let ourselves be exposed by taking a chance of having a creative idea? It might be a massive failure, but we're going to not let the fear keep us from sharing it.
Well, I think another way to say that beautiful sentiment is the basic build, I believe, the basic building blocks of creativity is this ability to change your mind, is the ability to think one way and then kind of broaden how you think to do something else. And this, of course, happens when you have children. I'm sure that people, when after they have children, have a totally different view of what you know, having a children, yes, because how can you know before you do it? And that's a situation where our behavior kind of changes our mind for us. But there's many instances when we have to change our mind before our behavior can follow us, you know, before we can. And I think that there's a lot of focus on, for example, leaders that know the answer and have all of the confidence to move the needle forward. And that's, I think, a little bit disingenuous and problematic when you have creativity, because you don't know the answer with creativity. You don't know ultimately whether or not it will work or how it will work or even when it will work. And so all that confidence is really bravado in the face of true creativity and innovation. And so I think it's retraining ourselves to recognize when we're changing our mind and managing innovation, what that looks like and how different it is. And when we also need to be correct and we also need to be efficient, because that's part of us too. And we do need that too. It's also valuable. It's just knowing that that's a separate skill and not necessarily transferable when we need to be creative.
Thanks for the call, Pam. Jennifer, just our last minute, do you see the tide turning somewhat and people recognizing that they're not really embracing creativity and starting to try to open things up and really do something with it?
I really do, Rob. I see two trends. The first trend is it's really easy to fake creativity. So you see Silicon Valley companies like Fitbit for dogs, you know, and they're getting all this funding, but there's not actual creativity. It's not providing value necessarily because you can fake it, and there are all kinds of metrics that you can use to fake it, and you can buy them in India and whatnot. And the other side of it is you can have true creativity, and it's very hard for people to recognize it, especially if they have expertise, and because it's so hard to break a paradigm. Because paradigms, the status quo bias, we talked about this when we first started. But I think there's this rising frustration. Why don't we have more solutions that we need? If you want to get a colonoscopy and you don't want to be put under anesthesia, you know, and you lose a day of work, you can't get the solution that's available, the pill can. You can't really get it easily. And there are all kinds of reasons why that is. But the problem is, why don't we have those solutions? And I feel like people are getting frustrated and they want more of them. And I think the more we get frustrated, the more we recognize there's a problem, the more momentum there's going to be towards understanding the second skill. Creativity is not just generating. It's also being able to embrace ideas, recognize them, and move it forward with them as they develop.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Jennifer Mueller. She is a social psychologist, associate professor at the University of San Diego. She's the author of the new book we've been talking about. It's Creative Change, Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It.
Rob, we haven't talked about this yet, mm-hmm. but listeners may have noticed you were off Central Time for a couple of weeks, and that is because you were on a WPR trip
right.
on a bus on its way to D.C. and bus made it to D.C. You saw the sights, made it back. Here you are. What did you learn? What did you see?
Well, I was in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital.
Mm,
you know, I learned this.
You.
Actually, that was at the top of the list. No, I saw some amazing sights. You've been to D.C. You've seen some of the big things there.
It was a couple
so
years ago. Yeah.
So some of the unique things, though, Ford's Theater, right, where Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, that had been closed for a long time. It's been open for a while now, and you can actually see plays and musicals there. So I saw an actual performance at the actual Ford's Theater, which I didn't even know was a thing somebody could do.
Were you able to concentrate on the play, or were you too busy looking up at Lincoln's box and wondering about the leap from the balcony to the stage?
There was time before and during the intermission to think about all that. Because, yeah, the balcony, it's right there. They have it decorated the way it was that night. Actually, it was April 14th, something like that. So just, you know, almost the anniversary when we were there. So that was something. And then I went to a lot of Smithsonian's that I hadn't been to before. Not the big names, but the African Art, the American Indian Museum, the Asian Galleries. They're just amazing stuff. Do you have a favorite Smithsonian?
The American Indian Museum that you mentioned was pretty spectacular. Yeah, we could have spent a lot of time there. A lot of time.
All right. So, yeah, I still want to go back to Washington, D.C. This is Central Time.